The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week with our global roster of fund managers, analysts, and journalists, both on the ground in some of these emerging and frontier economies, and also in major financial centers such as New York and London. We examine these interesting markets, try to clear up some of the misconceptions about them, and suggest courses of action for you, the listener, and potential investor. I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money, and I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments and the ones that maybe are not quite so promising. By emerging markets, we mean, of course, the BRIC countries. That's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, along with such other major economies as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. Today, I'll have a report on the United Arab Emirates, which is now classified as an emerging market, and its continuing status as a safe haven in the Middle East. And also, in terms of what's happening in the Middle East, we'll also be looking at the continuing upheaval in Iraq and seeing what effect that might have on such states or potential states as Kurdistan. By frontier markets, we generally tend to mean less developed countries like Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Panama, Slovenia, and Botswana. Today, we're going to be having reports on Angola and on Kuwait, and we'll be looking at the impact of the potential opening up of the Saudi Arabian stock market, which has been a long-awaited development in the Middle Eastern markets field and would immediately make Saudi the largest frontier market by market capitalization. We're also on a slightly out of left field viewpoint going to be looking at the phenomenon of crowdfunding and what it might mean for frontier markets. My guest says the effect is really positive and indirectly means good news for frontier market investors, even if they're not using crowdfunding. But first, let's go to Africa. While it may be overshadowed by other African nations such as Nigeria, Angola is a major economy in its own right, but its troubled history means it doesn't get a first look as an investment destination. Having gained its independence from Portugal in 1975, it fell into decades of civil war. After 16 years of fighting, a peace deal led to elections, but the fighting continued. It took until 2002, with the death of the main leader of the opposition, Jonas Savimbi, in a gunfight with government forces, to an uneasy peace being established, and the country has been on a slow rebuilding program since then. To clarify Angola's status as an investment destination, I have Africa consultant Aubrey Farubi on the line from Washington. For 8 years ending in 2013, she was a managing director of the Whitaker Group in Washington, a consulting firm for business in Africa. During those years, she spent about 70% of her time there and continues traveling today several times a year to Africa. She's been a regular on this program. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Aubrey.
Thank you so much, Gavin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Not at all. Given that Angola is probably not top of even African specialist investors' radar screen, why should investors take a look at it?
Quite simply, it's growing very quickly, and the consumer class in Angola has quite a bit of money, even though it's small. So more and more of the luxury goods players are looking to Angola, and others in the consumer goods, specifically South African retailers, are looking to Angola. It is the fifth largest economy in Africa, and it's the second largest oil producer after Nigeria. So in that sense, it shares some characteristics with its larger northern neighbor, Nigeria, in that it's primarily dependent on oil exports at this point.
So, as you say, again, and thank you for flagging those points. I mean, I don't think anyone of our listeners, unless they are an Africa expert, would realize that Angola is the fifth largest economy in Africa, although they might be aware of its major oil reserves. Would it be fair to say, after that long period of civil war, after independence, that the country has been effectively at peace for the last decade and that things have got a great deal better as a result?
Yes. You do see some political issues around Dos Santos' succession and what's going to happen after Dos Santos. So there has been some political violence, I would say, in the last 2-3 years. However, that has been mainly limited to the opposition party and the main party's headquarters and protests, and less pervasive than anything we saw before. So most Angola watchers believe the country is going to remain stable and get through the elections coming in 2016 without a major hitch. And because of that low growth, the low economic development that resulted as at the end of the war, you really do see a high rate of growth. About 8% is predicted for next year, 8.8 by some. So they're growing on a low base, but the growth is coming in quickly as major spending on public infrastructure kicks in.
Indeed, Anna, you made the point that there is a small but rapidly growing middle class, largely thanks to the oil wealth. Would it be fair to say that compared to its sub-Saharan neighbors, Angola actually compares quite favorably?
It's going to be comparing quite favorably. Again, it's hard to compare to a Nigeria because you're dealing with Nigeria having 175 million people and Angola having 21 million. So it's much smaller in that sense. But certainly, you know, when you're looking at a Congo Brazzaville or a Senegal or these other countries, much smaller, Angola does compare favorably, and people do have a lot of people do have disposable income. That's not to say that there's not a huge poverty problem, especially in rural Angola. However, as we know, oil exports often result in economic inequality, and that has both good and bad characteristics in terms of driving consumer markets.
No, that's absolutely true, and indeed, a resource-based economy almost invariably leads to fairly major disparities in wealth to start with. It's really a question of how effective the government is in recycling some of that oil wealth. But its oil revenues are increasing, and you mentioned infrastructure development. What are they expecting in terms of the government investing in the economy as far as capital investment and infrastructure?
Well, they're doing an enormous amount. They signed with U.S. Export-Import Bank to finance $1 billion of energy and rail transport machinery. The actual government of Angola they released a bond several years ago, and that bond is trading quite well, and it's been used to fund infrastructure, roads, rail. And additionally, Angola has its own sovereign wealth fund, and that sovereign wealth fund, which started in 2012, is the second largest sovereign wealth fund in the region, second to Botswana's, and it has plans to invest in infrastructure not only in Angola, but in other African countries as well, infrastructure and tourist assets, which is a very interesting angle.
No, indeed, and seeing how strong tourism is, or what a big boost tourism has given to neighboring countries such as Botswana and Namibia, and South Africa, of course, that's a very sensible decision on the part of the Angolan government to focus on that. But in terms of how does one gain access to it, invariably with some of the less developed markets, and this is something we've discussed before, I know, Aubrey, the way that investors in developed markets can gain access doesn't tend to be particularly easy. Is it fair to say Angola doesn't actually have a stock market?
That is true. There have been plans to open a stock market for many years, and they've been postponed several times. However, right now the standing plan is to start the stock market in 2016, And once it is started, they expect pretty heavy trading in terms of 10% of GDP. And that's namely through efforts for local content. So they're going to, the Angolan government will make some rules about, especially the oil and gas industry, that they need to you know, issue some stocks on the stock exchange. So I think you will see pretty rapid capitalization once it starts, but it doesn't yet exist.
So for the moment, the major way to gain exposure would be through oil multinationals operating there. Would that be correct?
Yes, that's the best way. Through oil multinationals and other multinationals that we've talked about several times over, Coca-Cola, some of the South African retailers like ShopRite, some of the hotel firms that Portuguese companies have invested in. Barlow World is there. So there are some South African players that offer access in addition to some multinationals. Unilever, KFC, DHL, they're all doing business in Angola in addition to the traditional players, as you mentioned, like Chevron and BP and Total.
So starting to finish up here, Aubrey, you mentioned President Dos Santos, who has been in office for several decades since the Civil War period, I think, in the late 1970s, is planning to step down ahead of the election in 2016. But he's actually in your town at the moment, isn't he? I understand he's actually in Washington, D.C., along with a number of other presidents.
They will be coming August 4th through 6th. The U.S. will be hosting a first-ever Heads of State Summit. 45 African presidents will be in Washington, which is absolutely unprecedented and probably the largest thing that's happened in U.S.-Africa policy ever. And they're doing a business summit, so we'll hear some interesting things on that. 150 U.S. CEOs plus 100 African CEOs will be having a meeting on August 5th. And already, Commerce Department, there's articles in the Wall Street Journal today and others saying that they expect to announce $1 billion worth of deals. So we'll have to see how that materializes, but it's going to be an interesting time for the dialogue around U.S.-African investment.
Now, that's a truly remarkable figure, Aubrey. I mean, 45 African presidents. I hate to think what the market in presidential suites in Washington hotels must be looking like in terms of the demand for them. But at the same time, obviously, it is an absolute first in terms of the number of presidents invited, but also the profile that they're being given. You've never seen anything like this before in your experience?
No, and I've been working in the U.S.-Africa policy space for 10 years. This is unprecedented, but like all summits, you got to wonder what substantive things come out of it, whether it's photo ops at the White House or, you know, there's some real deals being done. I am a little bit optimistic about this Commerce Department event on the 5th with the African CEOs and the U.S. CEOs. I really think that there will be some interesting information exchanged, ideas, and it'll go a long way in changing the viewpoint of Africa that so many U.S. companies hold. And just as your show does, help to educate people on the opportunities there. So we're all watching kind of with bated optimism.
That's a very nice way of phrasing that, Aubrey. Bated optimism. I think that's an appropriate stance. And thank you for saying that we are amongst that process and trying to educate people about the opportunities. We'll hope to be back with you after the summit and see what has actually emerged in terms of concrete achievements. Maybe some of those billion dollars worth of contracts that you were talking about. Thanks very much indeed again, Aubrey. Always very, very interesting.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
No worries. Thanks to Aubrey Harubi, an African consultant based in Washington. And as mentioned, she has been covering that continent for several decades and has never, in her experience, seen anything so high profile as the African Leaders Summit with 45 African presidents descending on Washington between August 4th to 6th. We'll see how that works out in terms of actual achievements, a very good point that Aubrey made. Just before we go to the break, we have an item coming up on the aftereffect of the turmoil in Iraq and ISIS the Islamic radicals who have seized a large part of the country. If you want a more in-depth look at that, which actually includes comments from some of our guests on this program, then please have a look at the EFMI newsletter, which is obviously short for Emerging and Frontier Market Investing Newsletter. Go to emergingfrontier.ca/newsletter or call 888-287-8229 or email info at Emerging Frontier. When I come back to the show after the break, I will be going to a correspondent in Dubai for a look at the developments in Saudi Arabia, where finally, at long last, it looks as though the stock market's being opened up to foreign investments. Please stay with us to hear about that.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. We got two stories from the Middle East this morning with one of our regular correspondents, Thomson Reuters financial journalist Nadia Salim. Welcome back, Nadia.
Thanks, Gavin. Thanks for having me back.
Not at all. Now, my co-author Al Emid, who produces this program, and I had suggested in our first book, Investing in Frontier Markets, that the opening of the Saudi Arabian stock market to greater participation by foreign investors would change the investment landscape in the Middle East. It appears to be coming closer. Could you fill in our listeners on what's happening?
Sure, Gavin. Basically, the Shura Council, the King's Council, has approved the opening of direct foreign access to the Saudi equity market, and that they've handed the matter over to the regulator to set out the structure of how they would go about this. And most of the expectations are that it will be a gradual and controlled opening up of the access to the market through possibly the regulator picking a few investment firms, major global investment firms that would be allowed to have access, direct access to this market.
That would make sense given it's the way that the Chinese authorities chose to go when they started opening up their domestic A-share market to foreign investors. Is there a time scale on this? You mentioned next year. Did they give any indication of when in 2015 they think these regulations will have been put forth?
Yeah, so basically the regulator has been working on the technicalities of this, and apparently things have been prepared well in advance of this approval, but they've set up the timeline of this to happen in the first half of 2015. So that would give investors enough time to sort of line up, or maybe for them to see which investors would qualify for buying into the Saudi shares.
Excellent. So what options do foreigners wanting to invest in Saudi stocks have at the moment? They're pretty limited, aren't they?
Yes. Basically, there's about around 5%. That's owned by foreigners, and this is only done indirectly through swaps and P-notes. which comes with it, the higher costs comes with it, as well as the inefficiencies. But that's the only way that foreigners can own any Saudi stock. So this is something that foreigners have been looking at for many years, and they've been anticipating it, and they've been they've voiced high interest in investments in Saudi if they were able to purchase stocks directly. So this is a major event for this region.
Absolutely, and I think it makes Saudi Arabia's stock market capitalization is about 250 to 300 billion US. So it would immediately, I think, become the largest frontier market by market capitalization should the opening take place as anticipated. A couple of your colleagues, Angus McDowell and Andrew Torcher, in the Reuters story about this move, listed one or two of the blue chip firms that they think are likely to attract investment. Could you elaborate on a couple of those companies?
Yeah, so we've got SABIC, which is a giant on the market, which is Saudi Basic Industries, a petrochemical company. It would have an extreme high levels of foreign interest in this because it's a global player. It's the world's largest chemical producer that's listed on the market. That would be an obvious one. Plus, you've got some major banks in Saudi. There's also an IPO coming up in NCB, National Commercial Bank, which it could be worth around $4 to $5 billion. So that's another major company that could draw a lot of international interest. You've got a very diversified economy in Saudi, unlike the rest of the region here, especially if you compare it to UAE, where you've got mostly banks and or property companies. So it gives a very diverse pool of investments in the Saudi market, backed by a secure economy that has oil to you know live on for many years, and political stability, as well as healthy economic growth.
Indeed. So, how did the Saudi stock market react to the potential opening?
We've got 2 days of a good move up. I jumped 2.8% on the first day, and again today we saw a good move up. And SABIC was I shouldn't say surprisingly quite a big mover on the first day. It closed up 6.9%, but during the day it almost hit limit up, which I haven't seen since another 3 years ago when there was a major handout by the king in the beginning of the Arab Spring. So it goes to show. The positive sentiment that is on the market right now on this.
Now, that's obviously a very important development. It's been a long-awaited one, I know, and when we were writing the book back in 2012, some of the managers we spoke to said that they had been anticipating this for several years. So it's obviously very encouraging news for investment in the Middle East and in frontier markets in general, that such a major market as Saudi is opening up to foreign investment. Switching focus slightly, but still within the region, with the Middle East crisis in whether it's Syria, Iraq, or now the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in Gaza continuing, is it fair to say that some of the Gulf markets, such in the United Arab Emirates, have actually held up relatively well and retained their safe haven status despite all of this turmoil?
That's right, Yevon. Unfortunately, the crisis is intensifying, but these markets have chosen to look at more local news, such as the Saudi market opening. The markets here in the UAE have been focused on, especially Dubai, has been focused on one company story, which is Arabtech, a construction firm, and the uncertainty around its board and management purchasing stake in the former CEO's holdings. So it's been very volatile and centered around this one company, and it has put the political issues in the back burner. We saw some initial reaction on Iraq when the crisis intensified a few weeks ago, but right now we're in the middle of earnings season in Saudi and some other markets, but political news is not on top of everybody's mind right now in terms of what's happening on the equity market. However, I think on the debt market, we are seeing some sign that risk, people are sensing higher risk on CDS.
So the rates that they want, the interest yield that they want to actually take on a Gulf paper is actually starting to increase somewhat or a little bit to reflect that increased political uncertainty. Would that be a correct statement?
Yes, that's right, Gavin. I think the credit default swaps have climbed to around 166 basis points, and it's the highest in over a month. So that's a reflection on investor sentiment, but none of it is reflected on the equity markets.
So you mentioned at the moment people are much more focused on individual company news and earnings season started. But looking longer term, one of the big moves over the last year obviously has been Qatar and the UAE being included in the emerging market index by MSCI, which caused a very strong rally. And then once the actual news had arrived, as it were, there was quite a sharp sell-off, certainly, I think, in Dubai. But longer term, there's both the World Cup in 2022 in Qatar and obviously the World's Fair in Dubai in 2020. Is that actually having any effect on the market? Are there industries and sectors that are benefiting from that already? Or is it just generally as it's been helpful to sentiment?
The Dubai World Expo 2020 is still pretty far away for it to have any impact on the economy as yet. But Qatar's World Cup is much closer, and there is development on the infrastructure side, as well as some companies have been awarded contracts, so that's being reflected somehow in the forward-looking earnings growth and the prices, for sure. I think on the buy side, it has been mostly sentiment-driven recently, but you might see when there's more concrete evidence of what the impact it would have on companies, then you might see maybe more of it filter through to prices.
Okay, that obviously makes sense because, as you say, they are some way away yet. But just to sum up here, it's fair to say that even with the various political upheavals happening in neighbouring countries or in other parts of the Middle East, investors are still able to distinguish between those countries such as Saudi or some of the Gulf Emirates, which do have a more stable background and which are actually attracting flows of money as safe haven investments. That really hasn't changed in any great extent over the last few weeks.
Yes, that about sums it up, Gavin. You're right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed, Nadia. That's very interesting and very hopeful news about the Saudi opening. Obviously, long awaited, and we just have to hope that it actually occurs in the first half of 2015, as the authorities have said they will. So thanks very much for that. We'll be back to you, I'm sure, to talk on other Mideast stories in the not-too-distant future.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, Gavin. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. And thanks to Thomson Reuters financial journalist Nadia Salim on the line from Dubai with that two-part report on Saudi and also with the continuing safe haven status of markets such as Dubai and Abu Dhabi. Just before we go to the break, Never Say Never Again was the title of a James Bond film featuring a somewhat elderly Sean Connery, who reportedly is going to be opening the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, just as Daniel Craig did for the Olympics in London in 2012. Another James Bond, although not the current James Bond, is reportedly going to be opening the Commonwealth Games this year. However, that philosophy, never say never again, is an important one both in life and in investing. People who might have given up on Europe, especially emerging Europe, because of the Eurozone crisis and its effects on Eastern European economies, and then with the present Russia-Ukrainian crisis, which once again has leapt into the headlines with the tragic shooting down of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17, apparently by Ukrainian rebels over the Ukraine. Nonetheless, European markets have actually done relatively well. Developed European markets have done extremely well. Emerging European markets have done okay, and there might well be further upside, especially as the Eurozone crisis appears to recede. For more details on that, please call 888-287-8229 and see if you would like to read a copy of the EFMI newsletter. When we come back, we're going to be talking, we hope, about the effect of that Iraqi crisis on other countries in the region. Please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets.
EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Market Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. As I mentioned before the break, the situation in Iraq continues to be fluid. The Islamic radical group ISIS continues to retain control of Mosul and a lot of northern Iraq. But as we've discussed with our next guest a couple of times, the major winners from the situation appear to be the Kurds and the semi-independent state of Kurdistan, which controls the northernmost part of Iraq, and who have taken advantage of the crisis to actually expand their control of some of the northern oil fields. I have Adam Chopin, leading analyst for Emerging and Frontier Markets at FIS Group, on the line from Philadelphia. Welcome back to the program, Adam.
Thanks, Gavin. Great to be back.
And you. I mean, again, this is something we've touched on a little bit, but wanted to use this segment to actually focus on in some detail on some of the exploration and production oil and gas companies which actually have operations in Kurdistan. The companies are listed in London and Canada and a couple of other markets as well. But essentially, they already have operations, and some of them actually have quite sizable production. Is that a correct statement?
That's exactly right. And before I dig into them a little bit, I wanted to provide just a quick update for the listeners on what's going on in Iraq and what's happening and what's not happening that you might see in the news. Militarily, as I've mentioned before on the show, ISIS is effectively stalled. They've been unable to advance the territory they control. They are making headlines with bombings, whether it's in the Baghdad area, by bulldozing mosques and churches and destroying other historic sites, being the sort of Taliban-esque group that we sort of would have expected of them. Latest reports are that the Beji refinery is still being fought over between government troops and ISIS rebels. And now, probably most significantly, there are reports that Maliki is losing more and more support amongst his own Shiite coalition, most notably from the Grand Shiite leader, Ali al-Sistani. Finally, there's reports that exports from Turkey to Iraq are down about 35% year on year since the crisis began, which are all things that I've mentioned on the show previously as things that could happen, and it seems like they are. But back to the oil juniors, there are a number of oil juniors operating in Iraq. The first to go into the country, one of the most notable first ones to go into Kurdistan, was Hunt Oil, notable because of their high political connections with President Bush, who was president at the time, and Dick Cheney in particular, although they have not actually gotten to production. The six oil juniors that have gotten to production who are pretty much focused exclusively on Kurdistan are Dana Gas, Genel Energy, Shamaran, DNO, Gulf Keystone, and Western Zagros. And as you mentioned, three of those are traded traded in the UK, though there two of them are domiciled in Canada.
That's it.
And then DNO is traded in Norway, and Dana Gas is traded in the UAE.
So, as you said, three of them traded in London, presumably because the LSE has been a home for a number of exploration and production, whether oil and gas companies and also mining companies in, how should we say, exotic destinations. The investor base in London is quite willing to look at areas which might appear risky from some points of view if there's enough production capacity. And what sort of production are the ones that are producing actually? Are we talking 5,000 barrels a day or is it 50,000 barrels a day?
It's definitely more than 5,000, and now they're at export levels. And this is actually part of what's been so significant. And there was a big headline article or front page article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday morning talking about how there's been so much production out of Kurdistan that it's piled up in at the port of Ceyhan in Turkey, waiting for export. And then the article goes on to tale the travails of these tankers that are floating around the world, which we've talked about on the show previously, which are trying to be sold off. But there's about 150 to 200,000 barrels a day cumulatively being exported now from Kurdistan. But there's more production than that going on. There's been production from that is being sold until recently, until at least recent crisis, being sold illegally or at least on the pseudo gray market, being trucked over the mountains into Iran, reportedly some of it being trucked south into different markets to get refined elsewhere. And then there is local refining capacity in Kurdistan to the tune of about 150,000, 175,000 barrels a day of refining capacity locally. So production, actual production from Kurdistan is probably at this point closer to 300,000 barrels a day. So it's quite significant, but not yet world-beating, but certainly on the path to become so.
And that's certainly a very meaningful amount of oil and gas being produced. However, having said that at the operating level, these are actually reasonably sizable companies, and this is a real oil and gas province, which now actually has some exports as well. I presume that they're not going to be a major weight in most mutual funds, even in the Middle East and North Africa, the ones specializing in Middle East and North Africa?
No, these companies are very hard to find in most retail funds. There are a few frontier market funds that will own a few of these names from time to time, but they would generally not be more than maybe 15 or 20% at the very largest, and generally much smaller than that. But as you said these are all listed in developed markets for the most part because this is actually very common in the resource industry, as you suggest, not only in London but also Canada and Australia are very popular markets to list resource companies in because there's a strong business environment for investment banking and buying individual juniors, and the regulators understand how to price and regulate these sorts of companies very well.
Indeed. Well, thanks very much indeed, Aaron. That is, again, just more and more interesting thoughts and consequences arising from what's been happening in Iraq and in some unexpected directions as well. I'm sure we will be back to talk about it in more detail and further twists and turns in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks, Gavin.
Thanks, Adam Sherpa at FIS Group in Philadelphia. That look at another angle on the Iraq crisis and what's happening with some of the Kurdistan resource companies. And actually, our next guest is also here to talk about a Middle Eastern country that produces lots of oil, but this time from the angle of demographics. One of our regular contributors is Peter Merrick, who is a consultant and demographics researcher, who is on the line from Toronto to talk to us about Kuwait, which we've looked at from the political aspect in some sense. But how about the demographics, Peter? Because Kuwait is a major oil producer, but it's not a particularly big country, I'm correct in saying, as far as the population is concerned?
Yes, Gavin, it's a very interesting country because if you look at the demographics of Kuwait, like many of the Gulf states, majority majority of the people in Kuwait are not Kuwaitis. Only 36% of the population, which is about 3.5 million, are Kuwaitis. So it's approximately 1 million Kuwaitis, and the rest happen to be foreign nationals. And that has a real impact on its demographic pyramid. And what that is the age structure, also looking at how many, the ratio of men to women, and also the birth rate per the entire population there. It really has it's a really different country than other countries we've looked at, that the populations are internally grown and they're not imported in for working.
No, and it's obviously been a major concern to Kuwait, because with all of these transit workers, it's been a source of tension in other Gulf Emirates, we know. Are there is there anything on the board as far as the Kuwait government is concerned in terms of restricting these immigrants or even sending some of them back where they came from?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because the Kuwait government wants to shrink the population because they are one industry, which is the oil industry. So their economy goes up and down with world prices and demand for oil. So they implemented something last year where all visas, all foreign expats who are living in Kuwait only have 5 years to live there, and they have to leave, and it doesn't matter if they've been there for 30, 40 years. This is something that they've just passed in their parliament. They also have it on policy that they will decrease the foreign workers, which is over 2 million right now, by 100,000 people a year, and they are trying to push through a bill that will allow them to have close to 290,000 expats, foreign workers, leave the country to drastically shrink the population.
That's obviously going to lead to a fair amount of instability, one would think, given that all of the service industries which the Kuwaitis rely on are obviously staffed by almost entirely by immigrants. I mean, one of the issues our previous guests have brought up about Kuwait is its lack of diversification, the fact that it has an enormous reliance on the oil and gas industry. Is that also the case as far as its population is concerned? Because could it function as a state if it were to actually carry out some of these deportation proposals?
Well, it's like the rest of the world, Gavin. We've moved towards technology, so they're implementing greater technology in the country for that industry. So they're able to replace workers. I think one of the concerns is the population has grown quite a lot, and you have to look at it. It is a desert country. So if they weren't reliant on worldwide imports of food and just basic necessities, they wouldn't be able to support the population. It's the reason why the population has been able to grow, because they've relied on the world to provide them with food and, you know, the technology for water and things of that nature. But just looking back at the history of Kuwait was once a great marineland nation. It was a stopping point, a port city for much of the trade between the East and the West, and that happened until World War One, and then it became very depressed. There were a number of blockades, first by the British because Kuwait supported the Ottoman Empire during the First World War, and then by the Saudis. But when they found oil, things changed, and the population is very small. It has grown to over 1 million, and these happen to be people who hold Kuwaiti citizenships. However, there's another concern with Kuwait. And there happens to be over 100,000 to 200,000 undocumented people living there. And these are people who don't have passports, don't have a nationhood, and it doesn't look like Kuwait is going to give these people citizenship or papers and things of that nature. And that's a concern with the human rights communities around the world, because many of these people have lived there for generations.
No, that obviously is a major concern, and it looks as though Kuwait, quite apart from its dependence or over-dependence on oil and the volatility of the oil price, also has a fair amount of demographic turbulence to take into account as well, including that point you've just made about the undocumented, several hundred thousand undocumented residents of Kuwait. Thanks very much indeed for that, Peter, because obviously demographics can actually trump even such major plus points as being the second largest oil producer in the world. So we're very grateful to you for that insight into Kuwait's demographics.
Thank you very much, Gavin.
Thanks. And when we come back from the break for our final segment, we're going to be looking at a phenomenon that's become quite commonplace here in the West in terms of raising money for startup businesses and unconventional businesses, crowdfunding. Could it actually have a major impact for emerging and frontier markets as well? Our next guest feels that that is definitely the case and could be a major positive for everyone investing in those markets, even the people who don't use it. Please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Market Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. We've been hearing a lot about a phenomenon called crowdfunding here in the developed markets of the West, particularly for startup businesses, whether it's technology, social media or the like, or for such things as movies and albums, gathering individuals together one at a time, which, of course, the internet has made incredibly easier. But it means also that businesses that wouldn't get a look in from some of the major providers of finance now have an alternative means of gaining access to funding. My next guest, who is Baldwin Burgess, who's a regular on the program, is here to talk about the possibility of crowdfunding being used to help raise capital in emerging and particularly frontier markets, as well as being a managing partner at Silk Invest Funds. He's a founder of Capital Attraction, the company which helps businesses apply the latest technology to attract investment capital. Welcome back, Bert Baldwin.
Hello, Gavin. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
No problem. We know that crowdfunding is one of the most frequently heard buzzwords in areas such as technology and film finance. How does it work in terms of emerging and frontier markets?
Well, I think it's one of the biggest developments that that we've seen in the last few years, because it really leverages up on our global connectivity, which is now the case, right? So I guess what is it? Just a third, or maybe a third of the world population has access to internet. Even more people have access to devices that connect them to the internet, and so what we have is now all of a sudden we have an opportunity for businesses and capital to find each other. See, the origins of crowdfunding was a solution to a major problem. In 2009, the financial industries in the developed world and in some emerging markets as well wound up in the intensive care unit, you know. And yep. So, you know, they sort of left businesses in the cold. And I guess a lot of on the one hand, there was such a massive job destruction that a lot of people were forced to become entrepreneurs. But on the other hand, they didn't really have the financial system to back them. So somehow we did have the internet. So a solution was found where capital and entrepreneurs could find each other. And, you know, when it sort of started, people thought like, whoa, hold on a second, our regulator is going to defend the financial industry. But it turns out to be the opposite. In fact, what they did is they rushed legislation or regulation into place to sort of make sure that it could grow in a controlled way. And so I think the it starts in the developed world, but, you know, someone from Kenya or from Ghana is also on the internet, so they can equally either apply for funding or essentially, you know, play along in putting capital to work. So everything's become very visible.
So as you say, the wide availability of the internet allows people with money to find people who are looking for money. And I think that you've described it as a sort of an online extension of financing by friends and family, which is one of the most traditional means of actually funding businesses. Are there enough people with money in the emerging and frontier markets to actually help provide all the funding that's needed, or is a fair amount of this coming from developed markets into emerging and frontier markets?
Well, it's first of all, the friends and family is a model that they're very familiar with anyway, because, you know, most businesses that start up, that's just the way they traditionally got funded. So that sort of makes sense. But the interesting thing is, it's that you don't really have to tap into large capital pools. This is the sum of many small investors. So it can go down to a few hundred of dollars, really, the contribution. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole thing. It groups that together into more investable amounts. And so I think, for example, one of the examples that I always like to use is, for example, imagine that, you know, I'm just going to just bring up I'm going to invent the case study on the spot, right? Imagine that, for example, transport in Kenya isn't working very well, and somebody wants to solve that by basically setting up a private transport company. And, you know, the people who are really going to be kind of keen to fund that or participate in that are probably going to be local Kenyans. But at the same time, that kind of problem is going to resonate with members of the diaspora outside. So if you're a Kenyan living in London, you're going to understand, absolutely, this is probably a good business because, you know, they're solving an essential problem. So what you get with this crowdfunding phenomena is that you can tap into locals who understand the problem, but on the same playground, there's people from overseas, right? And go on.
I was going to say, no, in fact, and I mean, that makes a great deal of sense. In fact, why not take it further from the Kenyan example? You know, given that this is such an enormous global phenomenon, let's just focus on Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. Would you have some specific examples, or would you have some idea of the amounts that have been raised or examples of successes so far?
Well, most of the stats that we have are really from the developed world. So I think right now there's about $4 billion in volume being transacted on crowdfunding platforms. Don't hold that against me. It's the last number that's stuck in my mind. And it looks like, for example, the average amount of funding is around $180,000. So, you know, it really has that small business flavor. Those are the numbers that we have from the developed world. It's still quite nascent in the frontier market. I think it's a promise, really. Although some of there's a good example. For example, there's a platform called Homestrings. And these people are targeted to the diaspora specifically. And so I've been to a few of their gatherings, and what you have there are essentially Africans who live in London or live in Washington or live in New York. Yeah. And these people just all chip in and they look at investments. And so that's the first example that comes to mind. The Middle East seems to be a bit more developed. They've got a few platforms there. There's one in Lebanon called Zumal. There's another one in Egypt, which also has Islamic finance as a main mission, which is called Shrika.
Shrikra, I think that's what
it's called. This is obviously going very rapid now. There's more than 1,000 registered platforms, I believe, in the world. It's just over 1,000. This has really only started.
That's a remarkable number already. To think 1,000 platforms and 4 billion, even if it is just 4 billion as opposed to some multiple of that, those are remarkable numbers for something that really, as you say, only got started in the aftermath of the financial crisis in 2008-09. You mentioned for the Shakra, I think, the Egyptian one, that there was a Islamic compliant element of that. Presumably, these platforms could be tailored to take account of whatever specific requirements the people providing the money have is the way that they want to have it invested.
Yeah, I must say I haven't looked at this model in detail, so you know I can't really comment in detail exactly what the requirements are. But as far as I know, is what they're using the Islamic format essentially just to appeal to a niche in the market, which is demanding for solutions like this, right? But you know, I haven't gone into depth on this model.
Not to worry. I mean, again, it's interesting though that there is some attempt to take account of local sensibilities when putting these things together. So just to finish up here, Baldwin, it would be fair to say then that if this model continues to grow as it has been doing, that obviously is good news for the economic vibrancy of emerging and particularly frontier markets, because it means in these less developed markets, you're going to actually have businesses having access to capital in a way that wouldn't have been possible before, correct?
Yeah, and I think another part of the opportunity is also it sort of brings finance much closer to the man in the street. The small business is a little bit alienated out of finance often because they have to talk to these people who speak in very sophisticated terms, and it doesn't always make sense. Yeah. But now the companies that actually find funding are the ones who know how to tell their story really well. And so I think somehow it's more intuitive for a business to fund themselves that way. Yeah. You know, when they see other businesses getting funding, just because they found a way to articulate very clearly what they do and what solution they're offering to the world. And I find that an enormously powerful force. I find that so amazingly democratic, and I think it's one of the best things that is happening in the finance, in the evolution of finance in the last decade.
Excellent. Thanks very much indeed, Baldwin. Appreciate those thoughts.
It's really my pleasure.
And as Baldwin said, the democratization of finance, crowdfunding as a means of small businesses getting money from people who may understand their business and who talk the same language. As well as crowdfunding, we've covered Angola, the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait and Iraq in today's program. Next week, we'll be back with our global roster of contributors and another series of reports on emerging and frontier markets. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emid. We're the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets and Frontier Markets for Dummies, both available from good bookstores such as Amazon.com, and are the publishers of the EFMI newsletter that I've mentioned during the program. This radio program, our books, and the newsletter mean we believe we're one of the leading sources of information about emerging and frontier markets investing. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.